Welcome to the Eat, Train, Prosper podcast, where we provide you sustainable training principles for strength and building muscle, effective nutrition practices for improving and maintaining a lean physique, and practical lifestyle habits for becoming a champion of your own health, both inside and out. Hosted by Aaron Straker and Brian Borstein.
So we wanted to make sure to ask one nutrition question and to give you a very quick rundown, Lyle. Like, Brian is the training mind, as you can probably tell from the conversation. And then I'm pretty much the nutrition side of things more specifically. Okay. So I'll kind of tee this up. My introduction to you was the Guide to Flexible Dieting book. And I got that around 2015, which was crazy because it was like a decade after it came out already. So my question there is, like, with that, it's been about 20 years since that Guide to Flexible Dieting book. And that was really the first of its kind of, you know, flexible dieting in what the space has really turned into. Now, looking back on that 20 years later, how do you feel about its impacts on, like, the kind of diet and fat loss approach in comparison to today or modern times?
I mean, I think, you know, when I wrote that was 2004, certainly nobody was ready to hear it. This is, we were still very much in the rigid dieting. This is how bodybuilders have always done it. This is, you know, nobody was ready to listen. But over the next, I would say the early 2010s was, I think, when it really started to change. And I started to see a lot more talk about flexible dieting. And there were companies that were like, there was actually a company that called itself Flexible Dieting Inc. or something like that, right? They were suddenly, and every once in a while, they would even mention my name, although not as often as you would think. And it sort of, that became certainly more popularized. There was still the same, you know, pushback among the hardcore bodybuilder. You know, it's kind of like with the macho barbell stuff. It's like, well, no, you know, this is how you get into contest shape. This is what they've always done. This is how you're supposed to do it. And there's a point to that, but there's also the reality. Have either of y'all ever competed in bodybuilding?
I did one show in 2015.
Yeah, right. It's dumb. I mean, look, make no mistake. I love the problem. Like, the physiology, dieting people down with, like, the problems fascinate me as a sport. Well, I think all sports are kind of dumb. Like, they're just, the sports have never, I don't like sports. I love the issues. Regardless, that population was pushing back. But the reality is that most of those people have either subclinical or overt eating disorders, right? They approach that line of what's called orthorexia, which is that, you know, that's when rigid dieting goes wrong. So I saw this, you know, this real increase in people talking about it and appreciating it and utilizing it. You know, if it fits your macros, became a thing, on top of, you know, sort of the more structured ideas that I had put out there as far as, you know, free meals and Reseeds and the diet break. And then, of course, they would finally start to study some of this stuff down the road. And actually, my women's book, which I wrote in 2018, in 2014 or 15, someone basically plagiarized my entire book, claimed she had innovated the idea, probably made more money off of it than I ever did. And I started this spite-driven project where I was going to rewrite it, and that spun out of the women's book. So that very much became a thing. Although what I actually saw happen, especially in the 2010s, people went to the other extreme in the sense of, suddenly, if you weren't flexible diet, you were doing it wrong, which is just as myopic as the other side of it, right? When orthorexia, when people became aware of that, people would say, look, I don't eat chocolate because if I do, I can't stop. And people would go, oh, you're orthorexic. You're like, no, that's not what orthorexia is. Orthorexia is a disease where you are believe that you can't eat something based on health or moral or cleanness issues. Choosing not to eat something because you know you can't control yourself is just being smart. That is not the definition of orthorexia, any more than I do know some bodybuilders, and actually Alberto may be one of them. Forget who was I talked to. And he tried all the flexible eating stuff. He tried refeeds and diet breaks, and he found that for him, it did more harm than good. put him behind, threw him off psychologically off the diet. Wasn't for him. So for him, the better choice was to keep a very structured diet. Now, is that the same as rigid dieting in the clinical sense? No. Rigid eating and rigid dieting is a mindset. It's a, this food is good, this food is bad, black and white, dichotomous thinking. This is immoral. This is like, that's really rigid. The way, even the way I used it was a little bit bastardized as a term, although I tend to be very clear in my book. And I'm like, look, the way I'm using this is not really how the research used it. They certainly never talked about any of this stuff. It was a mindset. So if an athlete goes, look, adhering to a certain type of eating pattern, you know, clean eating, is a choice I'm going to make because I know it will help me get to my goals. That's not rigid eating. Rigid eating is, if I eat milk, I'm a bad person, right? That's, I have failed morally as a human being. That's where rigid eating. So that, so I saw the it go to the other side, that if you weren't doing it, if it fits your macros, that if you weren't including certain things, that you were doing it wrong. I'm like, well, that's just as stupid. Both of these are speaking in absolutes. They're on different sides of it, but they're still both wrong. And I want to say now, I think it's become a little bit more moderated. I'll be honest, I don't really keep up with most of what's going on. If I can absolutely avoid it, I prefer to watch dog stuff and CinemaSins. But I think the realization, and this is, and realize a lot of my ideas about this have certainly evolved over 20 years, which is part of why I went back to trying to start rewriting that book and just kind of turned into something else, is that for many people, a lot of those flexible strategies, whether it's a free meal, Reese's, stuff like that, does more harm than good. It depends on the person. It depends on kind of where they are in the process. There was something else I saw with the if it fits your macros people who were so adamant that you must do this. What they forgot, they had been rigid eaters for 10 years. They had done, you and I, we all did it. I measured everything. I wrote it down. Dude, when I was in college, I wrote a computer program to track my diet. I basically wrote, if I had any sense, I could have, this was 92, I could have made it into like my fitness pal. I had a database of foods that I typically ate and I could put it in and it would add up all my, I did it for years. We can all look at food and go, all right, I know what this serving is. I can probably eat a moderate amount of this. But they were like, everybody should be doing flexible dieting. Everyone should be doing if it fits your macros, even if they've never done this. They go, well, no, actually they shouldn't. Probably they shouldn't, because if they've got a lot of bad eating previously, you know, poor eating habits, and I hate to think in, you know, terms of good and bad, but y'all know what I mean, in terms of they may be best off being extremely strict for the first 6 to 8 weeks to break those old habits. And actually, when you start really digging into the research on this, that is what's often found, is that over the short term in people just starting out, rigid habits often work better. Now, in the long term, they do tend to work worse. The key is to be kind of rigid initially as you're developing flexible eating attitude. Again, this is a way of thinking about food. It's got nothing to do with whether or not you do a free meal or do any of that stuff. Those were the strategies. Again, those weren't studied till later, and we'll touch on something else because I think it's worth addressing. But it's more a way of thinking about food. It's, I'm choosing to eat this way because it gets me to my goal, versus I must eat this way so I'm not, you know, a failure as a human being. Someone can choose to follow a strict diet, but if they eat something, you know, not on their diet or whatever it is, the difference between flexible eating attitudes, the thought process, and rigid eating attitudes is how they deal with it afterwards. Someone is trying to adhere to a strict diet. Maybe they're nuts, want to do my rapid fat loss, or trying to do something super strict to kick things off. And they eat something that's not allowed. The rigid eater will lose their mind and go, I've failed, I'm a failure, or bro, you know, whatever the mindset is, and they will go, that is the rigid mindset. Whereas someone who's developed more flexible eating attitudes will go, whatever, I had this, big picture stuff, it didn't matter, I can go right back on tomorrow. But that's a way of thinking about, and that's really what flexible and rigid eating is meant to really, can, I mean, there were habits involved, you go back and read sort of the early German stuff. And I was so German. Here's a super funny tidbit. one of the early flexible eating, when they first developed the scale and were doing the surveys and stuff. And they found that flexible people that had more flexible eating attitudes were at a higher risk, or I kid you not, this is how they wrote, they were at a higher risk for bodybuilding. Now, this is weird scientific language. When you say somebody is a higher risk, it means statistically they're more likely to engage in this. So it's like what they were saying is that, oh, people that have more flexible attitudes are more likely to be. Now, I think they were also using bodybuilding in a very vague, a very generalized sense of weight training. But I just love the phrasing. Like, yeah, this is the risk people don't talk about. Flexible dieting puts you at risk for bodybuilding. I just think that's funny. You can be strict by choice without being moralistic about it. You can choose to be strict while having flexible attitudes about it. And I think that was, you know, Alberto was doing that. Because, like I said, for beginners or for people just starting whose taste buds need time to change, whose reward system is dysregulated, there's a lot going on that I could talk about for another 4 hours if you want me to. All that stuff's going on. It can be reversed. There's even some stuff that gets into like Pavlovian conditioning and reward centers and all of that, right? Like it becomes a habit where it's like, oh, I hate this and it triggers the reward cascade and I eat more. You have to sometimes break those habits by being exposed to it and not doing it. And actually, here's just a random anecdote. But what it's worth, a kid I consulted with, and he had problems with this stuff and he was trying to lean out. And I asked him if he'd ever done like free meals and things like that. And he said, yeah, but here's what happens. I do one on a Friday. And then I'd go, I could do another one tomorrow. And then another one tomorrow. And then suddenly his diet was over. So when we consulted, he chose to do 8 just straight weeks, strict, no deviations, chosen or otherwise. And he told when I reconnected with him, he said, yeah, it's really changed the way I think about this. He's like, I would see these foods. Since I couldn't eat them, I just found that my desire for them went away. And then he started allowing himself one, I guess, to 5 Guys burgers, whatever it was. He's like, yeah. But he needed those 8 weeks of being strict before he could even try that. I mean, and this is part of what I would tell people now, as far as the free meals, as far as, well, I don't use the term refeed anymore because I think it, I had a friend tell me one time, she goes, I sound like what you do with livestock. She's not wrong. You know, it's not a bad point, but for the average person, when people think in terms of refeeding, I think it tends to push them into, I must force feed food. Like, nope, it's a maintenance day. Mm-hmm. Unless it's a very specific athletic application in terms of, are you carb loading for an event? Like, that's a different thing. But if we're talking about just the grand majority of folks, nope, it's a maintenance day. Just like the alternate day fasting stuff, it's just don't go crazy. Just eat normally, whatever that means. Same thing as free meals. For many people, a free meal just throws them off their diet and it's very difficult for them to go back to normal eating. All right, it's not for you. Or try it, doesn't work. Try it a couple times more. If it doesn't work, nothing was ever mandatory. I still tend, there's also the issue, and this is where certainly the research has unfortunately proven my initial speculations absolutely wrong. The metabolic benefits of all this stuff is marginal, if it exists at all, right? Any effect is microscopic. And it's certainly not anything I would bet the farm on in terms of recommending these things. Like, I wanted it to, I still wish it were. I wish I could say that 3 days at normal carbs and calories would reset metabolism, and the research, it's just not there for the most part. There's a ton of it. So, you know, I think my favorite one study that, did you read the one that called it the calorie shifting diet? Did you see this paper? They did 11 days of basically what amounted to my rapid fat loss diet in the 3 day of higher calories. I'm like, hey, he read my book. I'm like, that's exactly what I recommend. That's my 14 day UD2 cycle. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, the metabolic effects just aren't there. I wish they were, even with the diet breaks, although I question some of the designs, but based on what's there, when it shows up, it's like 100 calories in either direction. If that, and yeah. It certainly then has to be weighed against, like, obviously slowing down and taking longer, you know, things of that nature. Now, I still think of all of them, you know, the free meal is the one I think has the least utility for most people. Other than just, I had another guy I consulted with, and he said, look, if I can't go have lobster and steak at my country club on Thursday, no dice. I said, cool, free meal. Like that's easy. That was a practical thing. That's more of an issue. Maintenance days with a lot of people I'm using, like alternate day fasting, intermittent caloric restriction. I find that that's working really well for some people, mainly because it lets them create a big deficit without having to be moderately hungry all the time and supports training better. So I just like, on your fasting days, you're going to do my rapid fat loss and it'll be a monstrous deficit. And then on your training days, you eat at maintenance. Not refeed. You're not pigging out. You're not trying to, you know, do a box of donuts like I have done back in the day. You're just eating in maintenance. But I've reframed it. It's not a overfeeding refeed. It's like just eat a normal day. And then I do still think diet breaks have potential benefits, even in the research on bodybuilders that showed that it didn't have any metabolic effects. Their hunger did go down. They were less fatigued. It helped with some of the VAT recovery. Although, in my opinion, if more people would listen to me and reduce their volume on a diet like they should, it wouldn't be an issue. But it'll just wait another 10 years. They'll realize I was right about that, that you should reduce volume on a diet. And also, and this is something we can either talk about or do another time. Then I'll get back to finishing my thing. Here's my controversial opinion that I know is right. As you get more highly trained, you need less volume, not more. We can come back to that in a second.
Hey, Lyle, I love that. Hold on, real quick. I love that. That's awesome. I agree. I have to hop off. I just wanted to say that this has been amazing. I feel like I could talk to you, and I have so many more topics that I want to talk to you about too.
I'd love to do another one. I'd love to do another one.
I'll bring you back on. That'd be great. Thank you so much for your time.
I'm here though, so we can finish. By all means, please finish.
Yeah. So as far as the full diet break, I still think it has utility, even in that case, for extended diets, just to give people a little bit of a mental and physical break. Right. And if you are, you know, a dieting athlete or whatever, and performance starts to slip, then is a chance for you to bump up volume and have a little bit more recovery. That assumes you've got the time to include it, right? And this is another thing, like this is, I'm sure you do this. What people forget, like the question that also doesn't get talked about when we talk about or addressed when we talk about all this is, who am I talking to? What is my population? If I'm talking to a bodybuilder who must be in shape on April 14th or they cannot compete, that is a very different situation versus someone who just is trying to lose a certain amount of general population. Like, yes, I get it. And you set smart goals and specific and measurable and time constrained, but it's still not the same, right? My power lifter, if she doesn't make weight on Friday morning, she's out of luck, right? We don't have the opportunity to get behind. So there are cases, but that's the exception. And unfortunately, as I'm sure you know, so many of our nutritional and fat loss and diet stuff, it comes out of the 1%. It's assumed that, oh, bodybuilders are the best dieters. Yes, they have to be in shape for one day and you don't see them in the off season, where I guarantee you they're sloppy because they don't have to keep the fat. Right. So like, and I if Alberto listens to this, I'm sorry if he wasn't the one that told me this and I'm misrepresenting him. But like, yeah, the flexible eating stuff tends to be more important for long-term success. But if you're a bodybuilder who only has to be in shape for one or two shows or one show, the goal is not long-term. So the goal is not long-term. You're going to regain the body fat. So it's not as big of a deal. And if that helps you not get behind or whatever, yes, you got time, great. And if not, well, you got to be in shape and you got to be in shape. But the thing really where I think I've changed, like I said, I wish the metabolic stuff were more profound. I really do, but it's not. And I still think it's good for general populations to A, break their dieting up into more realistic durations. Telling someone you're going to have to be hungry for a year is exhausting. Saying we're going to shoot for 12 and 16 weeks and then we're going to stabilize you. It's psychologically different. And that's where, I mean, again, I still think free meals and maintenance days, it's like there's a difference in dieting 7 days a week for 12 weeks and dieting 4 days and having a maintenance day. But these are weighed against, does it throw the person off their diet? Do they lose food control? It just depends. But where I really think, where I've really started thinking more about this, and I wrote about this in 2004, right? The problem with fat loss is not losing. Never has been. The problem is keeping it off. And where I think diet breaks may have their biggest utility is to give people a chance to practice maintenance, to identify, to do a couple things. One is they have to keep in mind that maintenance doesn't mean you get to go back to doing what you were doing before. I mean, I wish it were the case. I wish you didn't have to worry about it anymore. It sucks. But there still has to be some degree of, you know, you got to do at least some of what you did before and practicing mate. But it also helps give you a chance to identify red flags. Like, okay, for many people psychologically, the way I've usually phrased it, like dieting is a goal. All right. When you're ready to put the hammer down, you're like, all right, nose to the grindstone, it's time. And just lock it. That's where free meals and even maintenance days, it unflips that diet switch, you know. But when they go to maintenance, for a lot of people, it's just this weird, like, losing weight is a goal and gaining weight is a goal. And maintenance is this kind of nebulous, what am I trying to achieve here, right? And it gets into, you know, approach versus avoidance goals and some of that sort of stuff. But it's like, look, realistically, you're going to have to maintain some degree of discipline. But you have to identify the red flags. All right. Do you find that when you go back to maintenance that you switch off completely and lose all food control? Okay, well, that's a good learning, because that's something that you can now address, especially if it's between blocks of active dieting. Like, you know, you're going back into this, right? Now, that early study, the one that I cited by Wing, was like, when people plan the break, they don't seem to lose control as much because it's part of the plan now, which is also why I tend to prefer thinking of it in those terms. It's not like you fell off your diet. This is part of the goal. But practicing that, figuring out those red flags, figuring out what might be an ideal maintenance pattern, which will depend on the person. And again, this is someplace I think I've gotten a lot more flexible in my thinking. But in terms of, like, when we think of putting people eating at maintenance, well, you eat at maintenance every day. Okay. Why? No, like, gender, like, okay, other than that's how it's just, that's mate, but why? Is there any absolute, like, necessary, like, yeah, hormones and all that stuff, recovering and all that, whatever. But in terms of, like, from a adherence standpoint, a practice standpoint, why? So one of the early consults I did, they were very well aware of their own eating issues. They were very all or nothing. It's just who they were as a person. Like, it's great to go, hey, be more flexible. And it doesn't work that way. That's not how psychology works. You don't just go, hey, whatever you're doing now, don't be that. Doesn't work. And they told me flat out, they go, look, on the weekends, I cook with my father-in-law, and I will not track calories. During the week, and at work, everything's structured. They're like, what they actually ended up doing for their maintenance, believe it or not, they stayed on, I don't think it was rapid fat loss levels, but they basically stayed on a very strict diet Monday through Friday, because they would get up, do their cardio, work, lift. They were structured. On the weekends, it was a free-for-all. And all I told them was, cool, your maintenance for them was 5 days of dieting, 2 days of not caring. Like, a traditionally trained nutritionist would go, oh my God, that's deranged. And I would go in, a pragmatically caring person would say, I don't give a crap. And the other thing I told this person, because again, you know, whatever, daily weighing and all that, which is now, nor everybody does it now. It's great. Mm-hmm. I don't have to, you know. And this person, I don't know, like, what population you work with or whatever, but, like, you know, you get those people that you can just tell by talking to them that they're a little nuts. And I don't mean that, like, neurotic. Like, I don't mean that negatively. I was too. I mean, I've had spreadsheets and graphs and charts and all that stuff. You can always tell, because I'm always like, okay, when do you want to share your data with me? When do you want to screen share? suddenly it's just charts and graphs, and they're always like in accounting and stuff like that. And, you know, they showed me, like, all right, I would lose weight and then my weight would do this and come back and this and that. And I said, look, it's real easy. I go, I want you to put a red line on your chart. Your weight never goes above that again. Because as soon as you hit that, it's time to get your act together. And for that person, I said, okay, your maintenance is 5 and 2. 5 low-calorie days, 2 don't-care days. Start regaining weight, go to 6 and 1. Get the weight back off, go back to 5 and 2 till you figure it out. And that's what, but getting back to the original thing as far as diet breaks, I think that can be very useful to identify those red flags on an individual level, is the last thing, and then I'd be curious actually what you see in the people you work with. I think the other thing that's really been forgotten is that so many of these strategies, whether it's flexible strategies, if it fits your macros, cyclical dieting, I mean, let's face it, I've read everything that's been written. It's funny, if you ever get a chance, go back and look like the early, the 1950s, like 1960s, the truly bonkers stuff. There's nothing new. I got this book in my garage called The Wild Weekend Diet. It says you reduce, you're real strict during the week and you save calories up to have more calories on the weekend. I'm like, aha, proto-cyclical dieting, 1950s, whatever it was. Nothing that anything you can think of has been done at this point. And they've all been successful for some, failed for others, and then most of it's failed for most people. That's just the reality of it. And what I tell people is like, look, all I care about is your calories and your protein. Everything else is negotiable and is context specific. How much training are you doing? What's your insulin sensitivity? You know, do carbs make you overeat? Blah, 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 blah. You know, for some people, alternate day fasting works great. Super low. They'd rather be hungry for 4 days and not have to care on 3 days. Some people prefer the consistency 7 days a week. It depends on the person. The other thing I see is people are just like, this is the way to do it because this is what works for me. Well, no. Try strategy. Did it work? Nope. Throw it away. Or figure out why it didn't work. Figure out what works. Because when you talk to people and you've got yours and I've got mine who have found a successful pattern for long-term mate, their individual strategies will always be different from other people's and are simply right for their situation, right? Do they have kids? Do they have family? I've done consults with people that are like, I don't quote with my significant other once a week, I'm going to be single. And I go, that'll make sticking your diet real easy because relationships just make it worse. Or mm-hmm. I've had a lot of people, and I get this, who are from ethnic families. And they go, I go to see my grandmother every Saturday. If you don't eat, that is an insult to the ancestors. I go, I'm Middle Eastern. I get it. Right? Like you have to take these variables into account. And since they're not the ones that are trying to get to 3.5% body fat on stage day, you have to find that long-term pattern. But the diet break is a chance to practice that and figure out whether it's keeping a low-calorie day in 1 day a week or, you know, intermittent fat or whatever it is. So is that, what have you found? Who do you and Brian, who do y'all work with?
So Brian has a pretty large scale, like group coaching program where he takes care of pretty much 100% of the training programming for. Yeah. So I think he does some potentially with a smaller amount of clients, some nutrition stuff, but like, I'm very in the weeds that, I mean, this is my bread and butter for my business is my right. coaching.
But like as far as population, is it like?
Yeah. I like gym population. So I have very, like, sometimes I'll take on clients who are like a referral of like, hey, this person really needs help. And I always have like a soft spot for those sort of people from a pure health standpoint, but mostly like gym population, people with like body composition stuff in mind. Yep. And what I find fascinating is like just anecdotally through, I've been doing this full time for about a little over 5 years now. Everything that you've said, it's like you spend enough time in the trenches doing it, you come to these same realizations. Like so much of it's just psychological, and then be like strategies for the individual. And one thing that this took me a long time to really find is once you've moved someone from like a, let's call them, let's like a male 25% body fat, you know, to 15% body fat. When you're kind of like setting them, when I'm now sending them off on their way, I always very, very strongly iterate, like, you have a new identity now. You are no longer the 25% body fat person. Like, you are 15% body fat. You need to live your life and identify as that person, or you'll just get right back to where you were.
Yeah. Which I think I've never been like it, that aspect of it. Is interesting. I've never delved deep into it, but there's a lot to that as far as long-term like habit change stuff and starting to identify as the habits that you're forming. So it's more than just like, oh God, got to go to the gym. you start to, you have to get to the point where you identify as someone who goes to the gym every day or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm firmly of the opinion, like, not that you can separate them out necessarily, but when you're looking at that extreme 1%, it's mostly physiological issues. It is dealing with, all right, how do I get someone from a male from 8 to 4% body fat without hemorrhaging muscle, without them, you know, cratering and, you know, those, like, yes, some, they can still have the same issues with appetite and everything else, but, you know, like I said, most of them, as someone I heard say once, if you're in a bodybuilding show, if you don't have an eating disorder when you start, you'll have one when you finish. And there's much to be truth to that. Whereas when you're dealing with general population and people carrying more body fat, it's more behavioral. I mean, yeah, you can't, and psychological. Yes, the psychology and the physiology can't ever be separated. But so much of it is just habits. Is, and I mean, it's something I've been looking into more recently. Like, I don't think we realize how much of our daily behavior truly is habit-driven and cue-driven and trigger-driven. We're not even aware of the grand majority of it. Is, you know, you come home, you put your whatever, your phone, you know, you sit on the thing, you sit on your couch, that triggers you to be hungry. I managed to train myself. I'm good after I go lift. I would go to the grocery store and I would get a protein bar, just like, because I like protein bars and something. And I got to the point that when I would leave the gym, walking into the store, even if I wasn't hungry, I would get hungry. It was purely like, it was purely Pavlovian. It was just a conditioned response. And so much of those eating patterns really are. And that's what gets into, like, yeah, you might have to be strict for a while because you have to break those, you know, either habit interruption is one way they talk about it, or habit replacement, where, you know, I'm sure, do you do a lot of like implementation intentions, like if then types of planning?
No,
like,
no.
When I'm in this situation, then it's basically like pre-deciding on what you're, you know, when people, you know, identify those red flags, which are a problem situation for them. And you sort of have them go, okay, well, rather than waiting till you're in that environment and hoping you make the right choice, you set up, all right, if I experience this, I will, you know, whatever. If I'm face down with a bag of cookies, then I will go for a walk. Whatever it is, there's, it's called implementation intentions and mental contrasting. It's one of the psychological habits that I think, I'll email you. There's some good stuff on that. And it's just like, a lot of it is breaking those old habits and installing new habits that overwrite them. The problem being that the old habits, to your point, never go away completely. They're always there laying in wait for that bad day, that bad week. During COVID, like 75% of my consultations were literally prior to COVID. I had my schedule. I got up. I went to work. I went to the gym. Now I work at home. My entire lifestyle is starting to disarray. I'm up 25 pounds. What do I do? Because it destroyed all of, like, habits are not bad, so long as they're, you know, the right habits and making the right choices. But that gets into forming them, developing them, to your point, identifying as someone who does that.
Yeah.
How long do you typically see that takes for folks?
The habit?
Effort.
So another thing that I love that you said, because anecdotally I found this as well with new clients, I tend to be very strict on the on front, and then we loosen things up. And because I found in the first like 4 to 6 weeks, if you can't establish that momentum, it's almost, if you'll fail. Or I would fail like 8 out of 10 times for us to achieve the goal. So I come in and I'm just transparent about it. I'm like, hey, I'm going to be strict in the beginning. I'll use the term escape velocity. We need to generate escape velocity from your current like habits and trends and decision-making. We get that. We build some momentum and then we start bringing things in. You get quick wins. You're pleased. And that's just what I've found or to really kind of help me shift my success rates.
Yeah. And I think that's absolutely the way to do it. Like it's, and you see that in some of the research, and it's like you start because it does, it breaks all those old habit patterns in one way or another while establishing new ones. And absolutely the thing about getting, you know, the early wins is key in terms of, you know, again, that gets one of those things. What's the traditional, aim for these very moderate early weight losses. And I'm like, if someone's got 50 pounds to lose, they're going to quit. When you go, yeah, you're going to lose a pound a week for a year. Like, no, they've already checked out. If you have to be a little bit stricter and a little bit more extreme early on, just to kind of get things moving. Like I said, and there is one weird, really weird data point. Look, when I look at all like the rigid and flexible dieting, and it's kind of all over the map, but the map to a degree, and there's some weird gender differences. But in the women, rigid eating attitudes was associated with more weight loss during dieting, but more frequent dieting. So what that tells me is that the rigid habits were better for the actual weight loss, but they were failing in the long term, right? Like in other papers, they were like, yeah, over 8 weeks, we actually found that the people that did best were more rigid, but developed flexible attitudes as they did, you know, whatever. They're usually doing very intensive behavior changes and, you know, lectures and things of that to sort of teach them about food. They're doing it while they're making these old habits. Like, that's kind of the sweet spot, to your point. Like, we're going to get you going, get some things moving, get that progress. Because there is another weird question that I'll come back to in just a second. Like, and then once you have that good velocity, you know, or good, you're getting good results, then we can start to experiment. And I imagine that when you do that, some people still respond badly to it.
Yeah. And they do. And it's, I like it as like a gut check, because they're like, they're like, I've had these wins. I see the scales going down. Like, things are great. I bring in some of my like old habits or some of these like foods that I haven't been eating, and they watch it like dry up. And then it's a very easy action result, you know, sort of thing. Like, I did this old thing that I used to, my progress dried up. Like, and now it's like, okay, I probably shouldn't do that, so long as I still have these, you know, progress dependent goals.
Right. And I think to even be able to see that, you have to be making the progress in the first place.
Exactly.
Like, this, things are just kind of here. You don't notice that, oh, this one day of this did, because it's not contrasting to anything.
Yep.
Have you, one thing that I've seen that's just weird, there's this phenomenon that like when people start doing, you know, dieting and exercising and stuff, there's often like, yeah, there's water and poo and all that. There's just kind of this weird delay before you really start seeing measurable changes. It's very strange.
It is in...
Sometimes.
There's things that you spend enough time doing it, you work with enough people, and there's things that you can't really wrap your head around, you know? And I've even found myself, historically, I'd always been like a first week pull the food, weight starts falling off, like literally falling off. And this past year, I did my like, you know, every other year diet or whatever. And that like did not happen for the first time ever. And it was really interesting. I'm like, oh, this is so strange. Like, my weight was still like staying high, you know, and like food dropped significantly and that sort of thing. But then, of course, in time, you know, 2 weeks in, things start rolling. But yeah, everyone's a little bit different. And I've never really been able to pinpoint why. And I'll explain that. I'm like, hey, this is going to go one of two ways these first like 1 to 3 weeks dieting. So you're prepared. And I just tell them, I'm like, we're going to find out which side of the fence you're going to fall on, per se.
Yeah. And that's something else. Like, we didn't get a chance to talk about this with a hypertrophy, but it's the same thing here. Research is finding, and has been for a while, some people are provably more resistant to fat loss than others. They just are, whether it's genetic, it's biological, it's how their metabolism adapts or doesn't adapt. There's some weirdness with actually aerobic activity. If you have time, I'd be curious what you'd seen, because I saw a study on this, and I occasionally get consults from people that do like coaching programs, and they always want to be like, I have these hard cases that I can't figure out. And then they tell me, and I'm like, well, I don't know either, but here's my guess. That some people just, I think also with women, it seems to be more variable. You've got menstrual cycle dynamics. You've got all kinds of weird stuff going on there that men often don't see. Mm-hmm. It probably has to do with starting body fat, you know, leaner, whether just, it's just stuff. But it just is. And it seems to be that any given individual, like whatever their pattern is, tends to be kind of what their pattern is. So occasionally, have you ever found anyone? Well, I'm sure you have. Then, like, you put them on the count, you know, you cut their calories. They do exactly, you believe they're doing what you ask them to do. Like, they're not, you know, underestimating or overeating and doing any of that stuff. and it just doesn't work?
I've had people like get frustrated and kind of like quit before I feel like I've been able to exhaust my avenues, but I kind of have like a check down process. And when things are like being not moving and they say that they're like adherent, I'm like, okay, well, this is what we're going to do. Like I want 14 days on the strict meal plan. I have like smoke check levels, you know? That's not moving, I'm like, okay, let's get labs. I want to see like what your, you know, fasting glucose is, fasting insulin, HbA1c, like, is there something off there? And then like hunger is another one. Like for example, a number that I'll use, like if I have a male, let's say like 6 foot plus or minus 200 pounds, something like that, and we're on 2,500 calories and he's telling me he's like really, really hungry, I'm like, you're partitioning your food poorly, right? Like right. I can stretch 2,500 calories to the moon and back from a satiety standpoint. So like there's kind of some gut checks I've had, but there's some people like they just have it significantly harder, and we need, our timelines are double. Their calories are significantly lower. Their cardio is higher, and you just kind of lost this lottery, unfortunately, to get done.
That last thing you said is kind of what I was getting at. So I did, like I said, occasionally, I get people who are like, I got these, and it's almost universally, it's women that run it. Almost universally that are having, because there's just some strange things are afoot there biologically, and he had like 4 people and they were on low calories and he believed that they were eating what they were eating and nothing. Like it would, you know, younger me would have been like, BS, thermodynamic, miracle, can't be. As I've gotten slightly older and slightly more mature, I'm like, sometimes weird stuff just happens. And like, yeah, you know, whatever, you can get water and weird stuff, but it never lasts for more than a few weeks, right? Like somebody's like, 2 months, nothing. And they're eating what they say they're eating. Right? Something is really off here. So there was this paper a year or two ago, and it was by this group that had done like a zillion people through their diet program, just like however many. And they were like, they had identified some people that were just non-responders, that nothing happened. And they're like, what's going on? And so they took a group of non-responders and a group of responders, and they put them on an aerobic training program. And what they found was that only the non-responders actually got an aerobic adaptation in terms of fitness and mitochondria, which suggests that there is some downstream, downstage biochemical dysfunction, like for whatever reason, their body. And so I asked this coach who told me about that. I said, all right, with these individuals in the past, what's worked for them? Because I mean, that's one of the first questions I ask people. And I'm like, okay, look, you're here now. Like, what's worked for you in the past? Or what hasn't worked? Mm-hmm. That's just as valuable. One guy tell me, because I love extreme diets. I do so much weight. And then it always comes back. And I said, well, then don't do that.
Yeah.
That, folks, is why I make the big money, is to tell people to not do the thing that hasn't worked repeatedly for them. But regardless of that, he said, he goes, well, in all those cases in the past when they lost weight effectively, they were eating more with higher activity. And I thought, maybe that ties in. Maybe there's we know there can be metabolic dysfunction when people, you know, develop obesity and with insulin resistance and other things like that. Does that mean that maybe if the body is unable to, you know, mobilize and produce energy via mitochondria, does that mean that there will be a more rapid decrease in metabolic, you know, will it be more metabolic adaptation or faster to offset the deficit? Like something is clearly going, maybe their need goes down. Maybe, you know, who knows? But it seemed like there are just some cases where people will just do better with more calories and more activity. Unfortunately, in this individual's case, he said, yeah, my people don't have the time. I go, well, I don't know what to tell you then. I go, our calories can't go any lower than they already are. So have you found that either? Like that some people do better?
I would say it's more like lifestyle dependent of the lifestyle that they're already living. You know, if someone's like just there's those people who have that like life energy, you know, that they just like, I train 5 days per week and I also play in this like intramural sport thing. I go on walks and I'm like, all right, we're just going to, you're going to have to eat a lot of food, you know, sort of thing. I have had two, and I'm curious some of your thoughts on this. These were both actual males, like 40s, 50s, insanely high stress lifestyle, like wealthy, you know, business owners, but insanely high stress. And we are like banging our, it's just not working. It is not working. Through some conversations with me and more so their, you know, spouse and stuff like that, they quit their jobs and the weight just craters off from those. Yeah. And that those ones were, both of them were at about the same time. And I was like, very interesting. The typical kind of lab work all looked like things were not perfect, but there was no red flags of like, you know, of insulin resistance to an appreciable degree or anything like that. That one was those two were like very interesting cases that I've had.
Yeah. I mean, cortisol, especially chronically elevated. And that one's tough to get with labs.
Mm-hmm.
You have to,
it's just a spot.
Four times a day spit test and like morning cortisol doesn't really. A spot check just doesn't tell you anything, but you know, you have to wonder, it could be water retention. It could be, I remember there was old data that cortisol can cause leptin resistance, you know, just, I don't know. There are sometimes you just see this strangeness. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are provably, you know, when you look at like how quickly or how much, you know, metabolic rate or NEAT drops in response to caloric deficit, it's just, the variability is enormous. And some people, like you said, some people won the genetic lottery. They get very small changes on a diet and they get, you know, kind of predicted fat loss. And others, you know, within 2 weeks, based on metabolic rate, will have dropped, you know, half the deficit. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, it sucks to be you. I mean, what should be a 500 calorie deficit is now two. And that's your now, the, you know, the predicted pound a week is now less than half.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a lower. There was, I think George Bray and one of the other guys that's been in this field for a zillion years. I mean, they've measured, you know, again, a million people over five decades. And they did. They found two women in their history that in response to a 500 calorie deficit, they decreased energy expenditure by 500 calories. Like, talk about losing, you know, losing the genetic lottery.
Yeah.
And people are, and as it usually turns out, people that have the biggest drop in metabolic rate when they diet have the least increase when they overfeed. So they're kind of screwed going both directions. And the people that sort of naturally stay lean and upregulate NEAT and this and that and the other don't see the biggest. So like, if you're lucky, you're lucky in both directions. And if you're unlucky, you're unlucky in both directions. But yeah. I think there's all, you know, to your point about the lifestyle, and then we can certainly wrap up, is NEAT is still the big variable in those. Because usually when people talk about low metabolism, it's almost always low NEAT, right? The people who were just super active. I mean, my power lifter, well, she's retired now. She was doing 20,000 steps a day just because she's a trainer. She's on her feet. She fidgets all the time. We had her at, for maintenance, something like 20 calories a pound. It wasn't a lot of food because she's light, but still, relatively speaking.
Relative.
Then there's me. I said, you know, most people, like the COVID people I'd work with, I'm like, if your maintenance is 13 calories a pound, you're doing real well right now. And I'm like, the reality is all those old numbers are wrong. All the old, you know, the 1.7 times basal, like not in this world, not anymore. That, yeah, those people that are moving a lot can use moderate deficits and, you know, still lose quickly. And the ones that aren't, it's like, yeah, you're going to have to be at 800 calories a day and it's still going to be slow unless you get your step count or your activity up or anything like that. So, yeah. It's tough. There's some people that just, like I said, provably have it harder. And I've been following this stuff for 20 years and nothing has come out of it other than, yeah, this happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do we do?
Yeah. I mean, so
nothing.
Yeah. Not yet, at least. So we want to be obviously respectful of your time. You've given us 2 hours. It's been wonderful. And it sounds like we'll bring you back again. Can you share somewhat with our listeners where they can find more from you, please?
So my website is and has been for like 30 years, bodyrecomposition.com. I got 400 some odd articles, although I don't really update. Like I got nothing more to say. All my books can be bought from store.bodyrecomposition.com. And I've got like 14 different books that I've written over my 30-year career. I have an Instagram at McDonald Lyle that I don't really use very much. I'm going to put dad jokes and dog pictures, occasional videos. I've got a YouTube channel that I barely use. I started doing some videos again. Where you can find me the most easily is my Facebook group, which is searchbodyrecomposition.com. It's super active. One thing I always like to point out, I tend to get people who are experts in their own field. Like we have 5 top-notch physios, top-notch OBGYN. People will ask questions about stuff I've never heard of, like medical conditions and things like that. I swear to God, we will have 6 people that had it and at least 1 critical care nurse who deals with it. Like it's baffling to me that's just the nature of my group. So like there is no question that I have seen gone unanswered, no matter how rare it is. So there is, I mean, I learn from these people like every day. So that's pretty much it.
It's a good group. I've been in the group for at least 5 years now. Yeah. And there's always,
it's the internet. We get the standard, you know, litany of stuff that ranges from super technical to super what in the world, you know, and like some weird medical stuff with, you know, people with guy consultant. He's got like weird gastrointestinal, you know, GERD and SIBO and all kinds of stuff, man. People in my group have problems. But yeah, lots of good stuff going on there. So, and maybe one of these days, right now the big topic of note, and we can talk, you know, I can talk about this later, the GLP-1 drugs. You got anyone on Ozempic or Wegovy or stuff like that?
So no, in full transparency, Brian and I kind of talked about this off air. It's like we didn't want to be the people to like introduce these things to people. I feel like it's a rabbit hole, and I remember about like a year and a half ago or probably longer than that now, is when I first started like seeing it and reading it a little bit. And it is just not an avenue I really wanted to go down, truthfully.
Yeah. Yep. It's going to put us out of a job if we're not careful, but yeah. So yeah, that's currently a big topic of discussion. I mean, it interests me. Mm-hmm. I think it is changing the obesity treatment approach for a lot of people. I mean, it's $1 billion. It's going to be a $1 billion industry. And certainly I think in some cases can be a tool to help with some of these other changes. But yeah, so that's a big topic of interest right now. Just
very big. So yeah.
So, all right. Well, cool. Please let me know when this is going to be out and get it out to all my people. And I definitely would love to talk to you guys. I'm sure we could talk for 8 hours and talk shop about stuff.
Yeah. Thank you.
Is your background in nutrition, like formally or just?
No, formally I was a software engineer. I was that, to make it very, very fast, I was that like 18-year-old who wanted to go to school for exercise phys. And then family was like, you can't make any money doing that. You need to go into one of the like science, you know? So I was like, okay, I'll go for computer science. Things great, lived in Southern California, you know, working at startups. And I was like, I am not going to spend my life in an office. I'm just going to go. But like the gym is always just where I thrived and felt at home and that sort of thing. So at the tender age of 30, I decided to start over. And that was 6 years ago.
Yeah, well, cool. I mean, I had a friend who was a Washington lobbyist in ecology and quit to be a personal trainer because they couldn't deal with being a lobbyist in Washington. So I get it. All right. Yep. Well, cool.
Cool. Thank you again for joining us. We'll be in touch about a second episode. So this was excellent. Cool. Thank you.
All right, Aaron. Well, good night.
Thank you so much for listening to Eat, Train, Prosper. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe or share us with your friends. You can find more from Aaron at StrakerNutritionCo.com and more from Brian at EvolvedTrainingSystems.com. Talk to you guys next time.